Hi everyone, welcome to the bridge. I have my friends back to talk about their new series, the CIA in Hollywood series. Welcome to the bridge, Tom Secker.
Hey Kara, it's good to be talking to you again.
And thanks for joining me, and welcome to the bridge, Pierce Redman.
Thank you, Kara. It's a pleasure as always.
I'm glad you guys came tonight because this is a really fun series and I can't wait to get into it and talk about it. For the listeners, Pierce, why don't you let them know what the series is about and where you're at with the release of the different episodes?
Sure. So the series, as the title describes, is about the CIA and Hollywood, and specifically the relationship that the CIA has with Hollywood and with the entertainment industry, as a whole. And in this series, we wanted to sort of, I guess, introduce this concept to a lot of people. Obviously, as I'm sure that many of your listeners know, that the CIA works with Hollywood productions. This is the same case with the Pentagon and the FBI and a whole bunch of different three-letter organizations working for the government. But what sort of separates the CIA from these groups is that their cooperation with Hollywood doesn't necessarily mean a positive portrayal. So this is a big part of this series. But more or less speaking, we kind of wanted to, as I said, introduce this whole idea. So we focused on a couple interesting characters, and the most famous one is Chase Brandon, and he was the first head of the CIA's Hollywood Liaison Office, which was set up in the mid to late 90s in Hollywood with the sole purpose of basically representing the CIA in Hollywood, working with different production companies and directors and different movies, and sort of helping to craft a particular narrative that the CIA would like to get across. So he's one character that almost follows completely through the whole series in that he was involved in some aspect, with a few exceptions here and there. And the first episode dealt with the sort of first instance that the CIA got involved in the movie business. And this would be with George Orwell's Animal Farm and George Orwell's book 1984 as well. Both of these productions, which were in 54 and 56, had a great deal of CIA cooperation. In the case of Animal Farm, we had the CIA not only buying up the rights to both Animal Farm in 1984, just after Orwell's death, but they were completely in charge of the entire production of Animal Farm, including putting up all of the money, finding the production company, and in changing the actual ending to Animal Farm. And then, so that was sort of to kind of get everybody, sort of into that mindset and to sort of introduce that idea. And then we sort of shifted a little bit more into current films. And we picked, for the second episode at least, we picked an actor, Robert De Niro, who has a very illustrious career working with the CIA. And then we moved on to the film The Recruit. We have Enemy of the State, which is the most current episode. And then we have three more episodes to follow after that. But as I said, we focused a lot on Chase Brandon, who is a very mysterious individual who I'm sure we'll get into in some more detail. And basically, you know, how he helped to implant certain ideas, to float particular storylines, actually creating a series of characters based on himself that appear throughout several of these films. I guess, you know, we sort of wanted, again, to kind of show that not only are they involved in this, but they are involved in a much more sort of hands-on approach. Whereas with the DOD, let's say, you know, yeah, as long as it portrays the military as looking great, that's fine. Whereas the CIA is much more interested in creating a complex sort of image of itself. Obviously, this is a clandestine organization with a pretty shadowy background. So, you know, their portrayal is going to be somewhat different, as I said. And in many cases, they actually portray themselves negatively, which is, again, something that is very different from anything else relating to government work in Hollywood. So as I said, you know, we started with Robert De Niro. We picked several films for that, including Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers, Wag the Dog, as well as The Good Shepherd. Then in the third episode, we moved on to The Recruit, which is a bizarre film that Chase Brandon was actually very involved in. And again, a character based on him appears in that as well. And right now we are up to Enemy of the State. Which again, Chase Brandon, very involved in terms of, you know, little tiny ideas here and there, particular narratives. And after that, we're going to have The Social Network, followed by Charlie Wilson's War. And then finishing the series off, which is a great sort of bookend, is Argo, which I'm sure many people will remember from the Oscars. This is a Ben Affleck film that, again, the official story of Argo is about the CIA working with Hollywood in order to create a fake movie company so that they can send this CIA agent, played by Ben Affleck, into Iran to help rescue several embassy officials who were displaced. They had to run away when the Islamic Revolution took place. And of course, joining us for almost all these episodes are some fantastic guests. We had Guillermo Jimenez from Traces of Reality on the second episode, dealing with Robert De Niro. We had Aaron Franz for The Recruit. Adam, his co-host from Themes and Memes, joined us for episode 4 with Enemy of the State. For the next episode, we had The Social Network. We had Thomas Sheridan, who I'm sure all of your listeners are very familiar with. And then for Charlie Wilson's War, we had me and Tom's very good friend, Sibel Edmonds, who runs BoilingFrogsPost.com. She joined us for that. And then for Argo, it's just me and Tom. So, yeah, we're up to episode 4 right now. We're releasing them every Monday and Thursday. So we'll have Thomas's episode up this Monday, followed by Sibel next Thursday. So, yeah, that's more or less where we are right now in the series. And throughout the series, something that was really interesting is, you know, me and Tom had sort of been figuring out certain things that we wanted to hit on, certain ideas that were prevalent throughout, and something that, you know, is just sort of happenstance. As we were recording, we started to discover a much more deeper sort of ideas that the CIA was putting in these films throughout the whole series. So we touched there's a lot of a sort of occult mystery school imagery that we see basically in all of these films, and a couple really interesting motifs such as the Willing Fool, the sort of, you know, master and neophyte. These ideas come throughout the entire series. So again, really interesting stuff that we hadn't even thought of, you know, we're planning on a second series that will sort of open this up even more. But at least for this first series, it's a really good sort of overview of how the CIA works in Hollywood, and all, for the most part, all of these films, there is pretty vocal support from the CIA, with the exception of a few, those being The Social Network, which, as far as we know, has no official CIA sanction that they worked on this. And then Animal Farm in 1984, it only came to light many, many years later that the CIA was actually funding these films. So that's a sort of brief overview. But, you know, there's so much that we get into in all of these. So, you know, the best way to really understand it would be to listen to the whole series.
Fantastic. What would you like to add, Tom?
Well, just that the series introduces you to the topic in a very, very broad way, because the sorts of films we were looking at, we put quite a lot of effort into choosing the films and aligning them with guests that we thought would work particularly well. We picked films that cover quite a range. I mean, if you look at, obviously, Animal Farm and 1984 are political satires, and the CIA butchered both of them, but nonetheless, the point of the film was still some kind of political satire or political message. But then you get into Robert De Niro. I mean, defining what Wag the Dog even is as a, you know, genre or subgenre of film is not straightforward. I suppose Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers are both supposed to be comedies, but they have elements of the gross-out comedy in them that was becoming really quite popular around that time. You've also got some really kind of spooky, weird, dark comic elements in those films. The Good Shepherd, obviously, is some kind of... It's supposed to be at least a historical drama, without much history or much drama. Same could be said for Argo. Social Network, again, a film that doesn't really fit into any specific genre, but isn't particularly like any of the others. The Recruit is rather a classic spy thriller, but it's a very, very good example of a spy thriller. And that's a really cerebral thriller, whereas Enemy of the State is very, you know, action and explosions and car chases and in your face. So we really, really did try and demonstrate in this series just how broadly the CIA sees its mission in Hollywood, I guess is the best way to phrase it. That they are not just interested in films that are overt portrayals of the CIA. They are interested in those films, very much so, and The Recruit is a great example. But in a lot of these other films, the CIA are never even mentioned. They may be portrayed and disguised as another agency, like an Enemy of the State, but you know what I mean? And actually, in most of these films, I'd say the CIA is either never mentioned, or it is mentioned only as a reference to a single character, or a single event, or twist, or something in the film. So the fact that they're involved in films that don't even really talk about them, or in the case of The Social Network, take pains to avoid mentioning the CIA, is very, very interesting. It, like Pierce said, it's much more complex, it's much more thought out, it's much more subtle than what we've ever seen from the FBI or the Secret Service or the DEA or whoever else you might point to. And that really is something that's I hope we get across, that I hope people come away from this season. If they come away with anything, it's to realize just how broad, how varied the CIA's involvement in Hollywood is. I think that's one of the core messages that is running throughout this whole series, for sure.
Well, it certainly came across to me, the broadness of their involvement. And you can't help but become a little bit obsessed by this Chase Brandon character once you get into it, because he's a fascinating character that embodies both, you know, the company man and, you know, Hollywood mover and shaker, like all in one character. And he's real, and he's possibly a real psychopath in charge. So I'm really fascinated by this guy and you know, his reach, his, it's, wow. Yeah.
He did a lot in those 10 years that he spent working as the CIA entertainment liaison. He was involved in, I don't know, actually, I don't think we've ever counted it up, but it's more than 10 films. That's the point. This guy was, you know, getting involved in multiple productions a year. And on top of this, he was also working on major television shows like 24 and Alias. And these days, if he was still in the job, he'd be working on Homeland, no doubt. So, this guy is fascinating. I'm really not sure what to make of him in terms of the where we'd put him on the kind of psychological scale, because he is... We really got into this in the Recruit episode. This is a guy who has perfected doublespeak. It's really, it's impossible to tell what the hell he's saying at any given point. He makes statements, and then immediately afterwards he will contradict it, or he will say something that completely subverts the statement he originally made. And so he constantly keeps you guessing. And that is, I mean, I guess that's something you could teach to a psychopath for sure. I'm not sure whether he is, or whether he's just doing a very good impression of a psychopath. It's hard to say, but this is one of those horrible undercurrents in The Recruit, that behind this twisty, turny spy thriller, you have actually got people who succeed in that narrative and in the world that's being portrayed there are people who are doing good impressions of psychopaths. And that's almost explicitly what they say in the making-of documentary. And this is a making-of documentary that essentially seems to have just been something that Chase Brandon put together, because it's mostly about him and mostly features interviews with him and footage that he provided them with and stuff like that. So, yeah, this guy is right at the centre of this, and he is... Just before we came on air, I said he is a weird bastard. That's the only way... Yeah. I can find to kind of quickly describe him, because he is incredibly weird and he is an incredibly unsettling individual. Pierce, where are we going with this? Where do we go with Chase Brandon? Because
I don't know either, because he is so bizarre. He's so strange. You're never really quite sure exactly where he's coming from. Aside from just his involvement in Hollywood, he is fairly involved in certain sections of the alt media in propagating the sort of alien narrative. He's claimed to have seen the documents from Roswell that confirm that in fact yes there were aliens there all along. He goes on shows like Coast to Coast and talks about this a lot. So he's sort of kind of everywhere. You know, he's not only in Hollywood but in the media as well, in the alternative media particularly. He's also one of these characters who implant certain ideas that are things that we wouldn't even know about. We don't specifically get too much into it in this season, but he was advising, I believe it was The Agency, which was a TV show dealing with the CIA, obviously, and he was very much in favor of putting in drones, and he sort of persuaded a particular writer, I believe, to actually have a drone strike in an episode that would kill some sort of Al Qaeda type figure in Pakistan, and the writer sort of thought, well, are you sure? I mean, do you guys even really do this? And he says, well, it's okay. It doesn't really matter if we do it or if we don't do it. But terrorists watch TV, so why not put it in? And lo and behold, a few weeks after this, the first sort of official drone strike takes out a terrorist leader in Pakistan. So it's very much about predictive programming, about planting ideas into people's minds before they even really take form. And again, we sort of see that with things like Enemy of the State, where that movie is not only does it predict people like Snowden, but it certainly was a movie that was dealing with the NSA and dealing with capabilities of the NSA that were now sort of getting a real handle on. And this movie was back in the late 1990s. So he was definitely, he's very much ahead of the curve. And this is something, again, that is echoed throughout this series with the way that the CIA gets involved in these films. Like Tom mentioned, Meet the Fockers and Meet the Parents very much play up this gross-out comedy. And this is something that I think the CIA had to have understood, that they understand trends very well. They understand what's popular. They understand how to take popular culture and to sort of mold it to whatever idea they want. So, with something like Meet the Fockers, there's lots of gross out humor in there. So it's really interesting that the CIA would sort of see gross out comedy and be like, oh, well, yeah, we should get involved in this on some level, because a lot of people are going to see movies like this. It's going to be a summer blockbuster film. Why not get involved in it? And we can kind of, craft a particular image that we want. So, Chase Brandon is a bizarre character. I really do hope that he listens to some of our series. it would be fantastic to hear from him, maybe even. he's one of a kind. I'll say that he really is this bizarre character again, who also went from being like a 25-year clandestine operative all around the world doing God only knows what, and then made the shift into, Hollywood big wig, it just like that, at the snap of his fingers. So, a great actor for sure, and someone that is comfortable, in any sort of environment, be it, running death squads in El Salvador or meeting with Hollywood producers in L.A. So, just again, a fascinating character.
Well, what you ever? I don't know. I think you guys are too young to remember this, but there used to be a writer of television shows back maybe in the 80s. It looks like he modeled himself after this guy, and I forget what the guy's name is, but I just remember as a child seeing, like, after one of his TV shows that he did, you saw this like short little thing at the end where you see this guy typing, and then he pulls the page off the typewriter, and it looks just like him with the turtleneck and the beard and, you know, exactly. So I actually, when I looked at him, I thought, that's the dude he modeled himself after. You know, that's the the Hollywood person he modeled, because this was a really prolific writer for television that I'm talking about, and I don't know his name. I know people who are maybe in my age range and older will remember seeing this guy, but that's what I thought.
Well, that's the thing that's so weird is that Chase Brandon puts himself in so many of these movies. In Wag the Dog, for instance, the Robert De Niro character looks just like Chase Brandon, complete with the beard, these ugly sports jackets that he's always wearing, turtlenecks. Again, in also Robert De Niro, but in Meet the Parents, he dresses exactly like Chase Brandon. The character in The Recruit, played by Al Pacino, is certainly based on Chase Brandon. Another really sort of weird, that bizarre kind of crossover between government and Hollywood, where these people kind of want to be stars as well. And it's creepy that Chase Brandon manages to kind of put himself in all of these different little movies. And like you were saying, Kira, I mean, God only knows how many people he's met and has influenced and how many little characters are sort of based on this guy. So, again, really strange. And I'm not quite sure what that says about Chase Brandon, that he feels the need to craft characters not only based on his personality, but physically to look like him in so many different Hollywood movies.
That is a really, really weird aspect. And it comes across, I think, as weird as it really is in the Meet the Fockers, character that Robert De Niro plays. And at that time when that movie was made, Hollywood had done a really good job of making mob members, you know, mobsters seem likable. You know, that I think The Sopranos was really popular around that time. If I remember correctly. Yeah, so and then you had those comedy mob movies that De Niro did with what's his name?
Yeah, Analyze That.
Yes. Yeah. Analyze This and Analyze That. So I wonder, you know, if maybe the CIA got the sort of idea to use comedy to make scumbags appealing, you know what I mean? It's just something that crossed my mind while you guys were talking about the use of comedy, which was kind of new for the whole, you know, getting to like the CIA idea.
Well, and if you go back, I mean, we were discussing this briefly the other day, Kira, and we were saying, you know, if you go back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe even into the 60s and 70s, a lot of mob movies involved the FBI, but they typically portrayed the mobsters as pretty corrupt and evil, and the FBI as, you know, noble G-men taking them down. And that whole dynamic around the mob changed in the 70s, particularly with Scorsese, but not just Scorsese films. And it really did make mobsters seem glamorous, exciting, made them seem like the ultimate celebrities, if you like. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Frank Sinatra. Let's not pretend that association has not been there for a long, 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 long time. But I guess there was a shift in tone around then. And this is when you start to see actors like Al Pacino and Robert De Niro really emerging. Whether that's, you know, just a fact of that was when they were born kind of thing. But you know what I mean? That it is strange that we see the mobsters go from being the rogue element, the rogue state, if you like, into being more glamorous. and less roguish. And the same thing, broadly speaking, does happen with the CIA. It just happens a bit later on, because in the 70s, the CIA films largely portrayed the CIA pretty badly as this, you know, pretty violent, corrupt organization willing to do almost anything. Whereas now, the modern, particularly the Chase Brandon-influenced productions, it's almost like this is some kind of gigantic joke. This is something we really got into in the second episode with Robert De Niro and with the Meet the Fockers and Meet the Parents thing, is that this guy exhibits, this character that he plays in the movie, he exhibits all the signs of a pretty serious personality disorder. He is neurotic, he is paranoid, he is completely obsessed with trying to prove that his future son-in-law is lying about everything. And he is lying about a fair number of things, to be honest. But like you were saying, Pierce, he keeps getting it wrong. He keeps being suspecting the wrong things. And we did wonder, is this a way of trying to make that institutionalized mental illness into some kind of just a sort of laughable, lovable, silly element,
quirky,
of our society,
you know? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Fun,
rather than,
you know,
rather than something really quite dangerous, which is of course what it is. What do you think it is?
Well, I think that's what's so interesting about a lot of these films is that with things like Meet the Parents or Meet the Fockers, they're very much disarming you about the CIA. Yes, Robert De Niro is a paranoid and neurotic. He's obsessed with the quote-unquote truth. He goes to some extreme lengths in both movies, including in Meet the Fockers, drugging Ben Stiller with sodium pentothal to get him to confess to some love child that he thinks he had, which he turns out he didn't. So, you know, and that in that way, they're sort of disarming them a little bit, because at the same time, it's gross out comedy. It's a joke, you know. It's you're not meant to take it too seriously. It's not really about the CIA. You know, it's about this sort of avuncular, fun loving Robert De Niro character. So, you know, on that level, they'll sort of disarm the CIA and again make them look. You know, if De Niro in those films is the stand-in for the CIA, he's constantly getting things wrong. Oh, intelligence failures, you know, that sort of message. Whereas in some of these other films, particularly The Recruit, but again, also Enemy of the State, the CIA is very, very scary. You know, they know everything. They can control your life. They can control reality itself. So they play both angles, where the CIA is sort of a joke, they get things wrong. In the later films, like Charlie Wilson's War or Argo, the CIA is sort of portrayed as this tiny little organization that's at the beck and call of the president. You know, the president can really kind of calls the shots. You know, obviously not true. And then in other movies, or even in The Good Shepherd, the CIA does pretty nasty things, and they're pretty upfront about it. So they'll play up the sort of omnipotent, all-powerful, dark entity as well. So both of these things are, you know, they will go to both kind of extremes, whereas you're never going to see the DOD making, you know, working on a Hollywood film where the army is a bunch of complete idiots. They get everything wrong. You know, they make stupid mistakes. That's not really going to happen. Obviously, there are sort of, you know, comedies dealing with the army, but they're never going to really, you know, go full force behind a big Hollywood production where, you know, there are jokes about milking cats like there are in Meet the Parents. That's not going to happen with the army. They, you know, they would never stoop so low, I suppose. So, again, that's something that we've seen throughout this series, and indeed in the, you know, the second season, we're probably going to explore this a bunch more. But and one other thing that's really interesting, you know, we're talking about all these mobsters and kind of humanizing them, and that might seem kind of strange at first, but when you go back historically, I mean, the CIA loved the mob. They were constantly letting them run operations for them,
right,
you know, in Cuba and Italy. They were working with them in trafficking heroin and things like that, assassination. So I think it's only fitting that the CIA would use actors, Italian-American actors like De Niro, Pacino. Later in Zero Dark Thirty, they use James Gandolfini, a.k.a. Tony Soprano, as Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA. that they would take them and use them again. And just in the same way that the CIA, particularly in the 1950s and 60s, was using mafioso all over the place in all sorts of operations. So, again, I think it's only fitting that they would change their image as well and kind of, no, they're okay. They're fine. You know, they're just... you know, they're just those, you know, boys will be boys, that sort of a message. So, yeah, you know, funny again that they're recruiting them, so to speak, again.
Yeah, it's like...
well, one thing...
If they have to kill someone, it's to protect you. You know, it's for your own good. And they're willing to take on that dirty work for you. And you just don't worry about it. And we'll just do our thing.
Well, and one thing I wanted to, that just occurred to me when Pierce was talking, is that this whole gross comedy element, this occurs, and why was that popular around that particular period of time? I think part of it, at least, is because that's when the internet arrives, right?
Mm.
And if you think back to the first American Pie film, which kind of defines this whole genre of comedy, you have what is the signature sequence in that film. It's the sequence where the guy accidentally broadcasts his attempts at whatever, seducing this Romanian exchange student, whatever she is. And he broadcasts it on the internet, right? So this is something that, at least in America, was happening at that time. And what did the internet bring with it? It brought with it certainly a lot of moral confusion. It opened up, you know, possibilities to people that they may never have considered themselves to be interested in until they found it on the internet, kind of thing. And I'm not just talking about pornography, I'm talking about all kinds of things, really. And this is something that, to be honest, we've never really come to terms with and figured out vis-a-vis internet culture. It's something that's still pretty screwed up, I'd say. But the fact that that was happening at that time, that you have that kind of redrawing of moral boundaries, or whatever you'd call it, and that the CIA saw that and thought, this is something we can use to portray ourselves in a particular way, that we can capitalize on this redrawing and this fuzzing of moral boundaries and moral lines and values and use it to our own ends. And you've got to wonder if that is that was their strategy, conscious strategy in doing this, which is what I think is probably what was going on. That's pretty devious. And not just devious, but very clever. You know, devious in a very, very cunning way. Yeah. That's not something we got into in the show. That's just something that just occurred to me now.
Yeah. Yes, because I mean, it makes sense because they're selling culture. They're selling
standards, values.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. What is more... And the whole morality issue is like, well, you know, and especially if you listen to the talking heads, when something happens and they let us know about it, they let us know about it because they want us to know about it. So, for instance, you know, oh, we shot Bin Laden in the face, you know, we took that motherfucker down. So you have the talking heads on both the left and the right selling the fact that we went in and shot him in the face, you know, as a good thing, you know, it shows our president is powerful and, you know, can go anywhere in the world and find this guy and just boom, he's gone. And I think the way that they sell it is like, this is the standard. And like, this is the way that things are done. Whereas if you look back in history, that would never be you know, the way that it was portrayed, if somebody was basically assassinated, you know, it would never be portrayed as this is the standard, like, look what we did, and it was a good thing, and, you know, yay us. So that's a real turnaround. And I think these movies are part of it.
That's a trend that we sort of talk about. Someone in the series is again, they're not even sort of altering little bits and pieces of a story. They're completely, you know, rewriting history in many of these films, particularly in the later half of the series with things like Argo, with Charlie Wilson's War, where they essentially, I mean, just whitewash almost entirely what was going on with the CIA and Operation Cyclone. So yeah, I mean, the speed at which they put out some of these movies, particularly something like The Social Network. I mean, Facebook was not that old when that movie came out. I mean, we didn't even really understand what was, you know, the quote history of Facebook, whatever that may be. But they were very eager to get a very specific, very narrow view of what was going on in the early stages of Facebook. Again, when the people that were giving massive amounts of money to keep Facebook afloat were all connected to the CIA, you know, through their venture capital firm, InQtel. But that's this sort of rewriting history in such an overt way. And you know, you were mentioning the Bin Laden raid just there, Kira. I mean, was that even a year after that we have this big budget Hollywood film where, I mean, in that case, I mean, we'll probably be dealing with that in the second season, but Catherine Bigelow, the director, and Mark Boal, the screenwriter, were given an insane amount of access, including allegedly being flown out to the mock-up Badabad complex at some CIA site in the middle of a desert. So, you know, they're very much now about getting ahead of the message. And I think, again, this sort of harkens to the internet age that we're in, where it's very difficult to keep a lid on information. It will come out. You know, you have to be increasingly security-oriented if you want to keep something, you know, keep a lid on something. And again, the CIA understands this entirely. And it's funny, you know, rather than sort of try and control the story or try and control the leaking, they'll just put it all out there, you know? And we can look at, again, the Bin Laden raid. I mean, we get these fake pictures of Obama and Hillary Clinton and all these others in some room where they're watching the raid going on, whereas in reality, they were just staring at a photographer. There was nothing in the room. So they're very much now about kind of let's get out there. Let's get out there. Let's recreate an event that took place just a few months ago. Again, there's at least going to be two different Snowden movies coming out. And there's still about a million questions about Snowden we don't have answered yet. So again,
And he's still in Russia. He hasn't even come back to face a trial or whatever else.
Yes.
It's presumably the end and the denouement of this great Snowden tale. So the movies aren't going to be able to tell that part of the story, whatever it is. Mm. So that's crazy. Sorry, go on, Pierce. But yeah, well, you're absolutely right.
No, it's really crazy, and it shows again the unprecedented level to which the CIA wants to not only, you know, craft culture, but create culture, to create whole new narratives, to push certain moral ideas onto the American public. And of course, I mean, on a sort of global public, because everybody on the world consumes Hollywood cinema. This is just, it's the biggest film industry on the planet. You know, even if you live in, you know, the middle of Tajikistan, you know about Hollywood movies. You've seen them. This is about a global reach and about appealing to a global market. But yeah, I mean, this really goes to show that they are very much about creating, about altering one's reality. And this is something that we get to throughout the series, sort of going back to this sort of weird occult thing going on within the CIA. I mean, they're very much involved in some sort of black magic kind of rituals throughout a lot of these films, where they are presenting you with something and then completely altering your own reality and altering your sort of preconceived notions and mixing them all up and then coming up with a completely different idea. And that is essentially the concept of magic itself. So, but you know, they're doing this with historical events. They are doing this with sort of cultural events, things like Facebook. I mean, you know, who knows to what level this will get to. But and again, I really hope that comes across, that this isn't, there are other people that have talked about CIA involvement in Hollywood, but it's generally very sort of base. It's very much, they want to have a good image. And of course, there are shows out there that are doing that, like Alias, like even Homeland to a degree. But, you know, what sort of separates that is that this is on another level. This is really not about a good image. This is about, you know, changing an image. It's about constantly recreating your image. And again, that's something that the CIA in general, in its operations, it's very good at. They're never comfortable when a situation is static. They're always evolving. It's a very fluid type of network of people that are working at the CIA. So again, they're very comfortable with the ever-changing cultural norms that are going on in Hollywood. And, as Hollywood becomes more gross and nasty with things, so does the CIA's CIA's role in helping craft these movies. When they need to be very serious, they can be serious. When they need to be funny, they can be funny. When they need to be kind of ambiguous, when they need to be hidden, like in The Social Network, they can be completely hidden. So again, it just sort of goes to show that this is an organization that really not only understands Hollywood, but understands culture, understands pop culture, and understands how to manipulate that and to get really fantastic results. Because I think that a lot of people might be aware of the idea that the CIA is there, but I was just recently talking with a good friend of mine who lives in LA, and he kind of had no idea to the extent that this was going on. The simple things, if you're going to film Langley, you need to get approval. You need, the CIA has to sign off on your script. Little things like that. Then to crafting entire movies, being involved in the writing. It's all-encompassing force, and I think they definitely have the monopoly on Hollywood right now.
So not only do they craft the narrative, but they also maintain it as well, or shift and change it when they need it. So, you know, that's why a figure like a Chase Brandon figure, who's there coordinating that overall narrative between all of these movies and changing it at will, or, you know, tweaking it or maintaining what they want to maintain in that narrative, it really does boggle the mind at the extent to which this agency would go to create culture and to craft a moral philosophy to sell to the minds that are consuming this media.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, though, I wonder about this, because you look at the DOD's history in Hollywood, which is it's a lot longer, it's a lot bigger, it's at least a lot more overt than the CIA. They didn't exactly invent the action movie, but they certainly played a huge role in defining what an action movie is and should be. Because I'm just thinking, prior to the DOD really, really invading Hollywood after the Second World War, most action movies were based around, I suppose a lot of them were Westerns, actually.
Yeah.
You have early Westerns before that. So it's all guys on horseback. Once the DOD gets involved, well, then it's got to be cars, planes, boats. It's a lot of vehicles. It's a lot of oil, basically. It's kind of, you know, the underlying difference, I suppose. It's an oil-based form of action, and thus, you get the big explosions, you get the big, you know, let's blow up a load of kerosene in a building and whatever. All of that was very much something that the DOD encouraged and was a part of creating this. Although, to say that, so were the CIA. This is something we're going to get into in the second series. They were involved in, going back to at least the 60s, in providing certain technologies to filmmakers to help them spice up their films, if you like. And that's primarily what the DOD's role is in lending them some fighter jets, or, you know, saying you can film some fighter jets or whatever. And so the CIA is obviously a lot more subtle, and it's much more concerned with people's, like we're saying, with their moral sensibilities, with where they draw moral lines and how they conceive of values. But the DOD were, I think, quite seriously involved in culture creation, and particularly in terms of shaping what we conceive of as an action movie. And as a result, a lot of the action movies that don't have DOD involvement have to kind of suck up to that, because that's the standard of action movies, right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the scale, I suppose in particular, another thing that changed is the scale of violence that was possible in these films. Because if all you've got, I mean, I suppose some cowboy films can be quite violent, but nonetheless, at best, you've got a bunch of guys on horses with rifles. Whereas once the DOD get involved, well, you've got bombs, you've got planes that can gun people down, you've got helicopters with bleeding heat-seeking missiles on the side of them. You've got all sorts. You know what I mean? It changed. It did actually change, I suppose, the moral values, and thus the moral response to, at least visually, seeing violence on the screen. And yeah, this is quite profound. I think, because this is, like you were saying, Pierce, this is the world's biggest movie culture. This is watched all over the world and has been for decades. And they make most of the world's best, you say best, but most impressive, visually impressive films, and most kind of technologically sophisticated films. So they really are setting the standards of expectation all over the world for what films should be, what they should look like, what they should contain, and obviously what they shouldn't contain. Because once you swamp a market with expectations of it should be this way, it's very, very hard for anything else to get a voice and for anyone else to turn up and say, well, shouldn't we be telling this kind of story every once in a while? Oh, no, shut up. You know, that's not how things are done. You know, once values and norms are established, it becomes very hard to break them, doesn't it?
Mm. Oh, well, now movies, you know, all movies have to have naked women and violence. That's just sort of, you know, if you want to have a popular film or a TV show for that matter, you've got to have both of those things in there. And in the most sort of gratuitous sort of way, you know, just violence for violence and, you know, tits for tits. There's no sort of like middle ground there. There's no sort of artistic sense to any of this. So, yeah. And I sort of piggyback on what you were saying, Tom, about, you know, after World War II, when they get involved, it's all, you know, it's a sort of military hardware. Now it's like, you know, there's a CSI cyber. You know, we're supposed to think that it's really exciting to watch people sitting in front of a computer screen, you know, typing. You know, as the internet has become more and more popular and more, you know, powerful, so have, you know, all these films now. I mean, we've got, like, there's a new movie, Black Hat. You know, there's always, you know, hacker culture. It's meant to, you know, it's exciting and sexy, you know, and it's a bunch of nerdy guys sitting at a computer. It's not that exciting to watch. But they're pushing it in such a way that soon that will be, you know, it'll be action and naked women and guys, you know, typing really fast on a computer. That will become the new sort of thing. And everybody's got to have that.
Well, and the thing that I always find so ridiculous about those hackers, right, is you get this character, it's the same basic character that turns up in every film since, I'd say, Die Hard, if not possibly even before that, who is the, you know, the genius hacker who's part of some criminal gang because they need him because he can get into the system to do whatever it is they're doing. Why is it that he has to sit there with a laptop actually going... I mean... He's a hacker. Has he not got this set up in a bit of software? So he just, you know, double clicks on a script on his desktop and it just automatically does it all for him. He's supposed to be a computer genius. And yet he's there doing all the hard work, typing it out. But like you say, Pierce, because otherwise it would be incredibly boring. It'd just be a guy pressing one key on a laptop and then sitting there for about 3 hours letting it do all the work for him. And no one, literally no one, would watch a film like that. Whereas you add in, you know, some close-up shots of the tapping away, for some reason people buy into that. It is odd that that has become a standard of action movies. I mean, even in films like, you know, White House Down is another one who has this exact same character in it. And that's a film that has all kinds of absurd violence in it. There's no reason to have this hacker character in there, really, to be honest. There's like plenty of other distractions and things. But yet, like you say, it's like they can't make a film like that without a character like that anymore, because that's, I suppose it's two things. It's firstly, you know, establishing the cyber terrorist. That's rather obvious and blunt and obvious and straightforward. But it's also about, I think, because old action movies would appeal to people who were quite physical and quite sporty, if you like, and they were missing out. Well, what about all the other people? What about all the Mark Zuckerbergs of this world?
Right.
You know, your 90-pound nerds. your Harry Potters, whatever. so you are starting to see more and more movies catering to them in terms of glamorizing their potential role in all of this exciting, wild, controversial, radical stuff that is apparently going on. That mostly seems to take place in movies rather than in the real world. But you know what I mean? That there again, it's establishing a new value and inviting a new audience and a new market, of course, into this, into the fold, into this whole culture.
I was just thinking about the scene in The Social Network where Zuckerberg he's attempting to find some programmers that he's going to take out to Palo Alto when they're going to sort of expand Facebook. And you know, it's this ridiculous fucking scene with like four guys sat around a table and they're all hacking away at you know, who knows what the hell they're really doing, but they're hacking and they're taking shots every 5 seconds. And there's this giant group of people around them screaming and shouting and they've got signs up and, you know, it looks like they're watching like some underground fight club or something going on.
Yeah.
And you can't even tell what the hell these guys are doing. They're just banging away at a keyboard. And it's this, you know, it's this exciting scene and the music kicks off and then boom, they're in Palo Alto and it's super cool and they got all this money. And how is that exciting? I don't know how that's exciting to people. But again, they put that in the film. They've got that's the new sort of chic thing to have in all Hollywood movies. And again, as I was saying, I mean, it's like CSI Cyber and, you know, NCIS tech work. It's so ridiculous that this could even be considered cool. and of course, the fact that so many of these shows always have the sort of nefarious black hat hacker that then become, you know, goes and works for the FBI's criminal thing, and that's, we're supposed to accept that, but not that, well, Snowden, but he's real. No, even though he worked for the CIA and, you know, all these sort of things, that's different though. But again, you know, they're sort of playing that doublethink there, where yes, certain of them, well, of course, yeah, this is evil hackers, but then they become good. So, you know, again, I'm just waiting for Snowden. You know, he was good, then he was bad, then now he's good, and, you know, maybe he'll go bad again. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, that it's a mystery, isn't it? Where the Snowden story is going to go? I mean, just wow, you know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I try and use Daniel Ellsberg as the prototype for Snowden, and Ellsberg ended up facing a trial, but because it emerged at his trial that basically the FBI were tapping all of his phones and harassing him and, you know, breaking into his psychiatrist's office and all of this sort of thing, and because of all of that was going on, the charges against him basically got, you know, shoved to one side because... I mean, I don't know how that even equates, though, because if he was guilty of what he was supposed to be guilty of, he was still guilty if the FBI then persecuted him. I mean, it's wrong that they persecuted him, but okay, so you prosecute Ellsberg, and then you prosecute the FBI agents who are persecuting him. What's wrong with that? But no, they swept the whole thing under the rug and just kind of nullified it. And I have a feeling a similar sort of scenario, possibly slightly worse, where Snowden serves, you know, 18 months jail time in some minimum security garden, something like that. It's probably going to end up similar, at least, to the Ellsberg story. That's my guess. I could be completely wrong about this. They may have a twist in the tail that we're just not seeing coming.
Well, you know, Snowden's a great example of how they always tell you exactly what they're up to, just not completely obvious, because he's said, I still work for them. I'm still, you know, doing their bidding, basically, kind of thing. Like, so they do let you know what they're up to, but it's a sort of in-between-the-lines type of a clue, I guess.
Well, and it was like with Snowden's admission as to where he was on 9/11, which seems to have... This is always what I ask of people who are so believing of Snowden, is, okay, if you believe this idea that this guy was a genuine whistleblower and that he didn't get involved with the US intelligence until he joined the CIA in, like, 2005, 2006, something like that, then the question is, what was this guy doing outside the NSA headquarters on Fort Meade, which is a military base, on the morning of 9/11, in the middle of the world's biggest terrorist attack? This 18-year-old high school dropout is wandering around Fort Meade listening to their radio, listening to the 9/11 attack going on. What the hell is happening there? Unless this guy is a spook, and was a spook for a long time, was recruited at a pretty young age, that whole story doesn't make any sense. And it either didn't happen, in which case Snowden is lying about where he was on 9/11 for some bizarre fucking reason, or it did happen, in which case the guy was a spook since he was about 14 years old. Mm. So those are your two possibilities, really. And yet that statement, which is on videotape, you know, there's no disputing that Snowden said this, it seems to have just washed over the whole dialogue. And he's admitting so much just in that one little, you know, 10 seconds of talking, and you just wonder, how is it that they've managed to pull the wool over so many people's eyes, while, like you say, Kira, at the same time basically telling you what it is that they're doing? It's warped. It really is. I'm ranting.
Yeah, it's almost like a form of duper's delight in a way, you know. Like, you know, they probably just like get a secret kick out of, look, we really told them what we're up to, and they still don't know.
Go on, sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, I think the CIA loves that. That's their, that is how they get off many times, is this sort of, you know, if you know what you're looking at, if you know what you're watching, what you're reading, if you can read between the lines, they're telling you everything that you need to know. And again, I think, you know, this is something that Sybil Edmonds has talked about in her book, The Lone Gladio, that, you know, these big things like CNN, I mean, they're broadcasting information specifically from the CIA with the intent of this being a sort of coded message for those in the know. So again, with Snowden, I think that's part of them sort of relaying information to people. You know, if you watch the Brian Williams interview where he's talking about 9/11 and being at Fort Meade for whatever reason, one, I think that sort of reveals to certain people, oh, okay, this guy is one of us. That's what they're doing. And also, again, this sort of occult secret knowledge that they gain power from, that, from being sort of open but not really. I mean, that's power over other people, that they're able to sort of dupe us, to trick us, to change our reality. That's a powerful element, especially when it's in the hands of this secretive, horrifying, you know, company, the CIA.
Right, that's a good point. And one of the aspects that I hadn't really considered before I started listening to the series is how these movies, some of them are like your own initiation into this secret sort of dark world. And I really never thought of it like that before. So I wonder if you might get into that a little bit about a little more about the occult aspect and the initiation aspect of the Watcher themselves.
Sure. Well, I guess, I mean, all movies do this to a certain extent, or all movies that show you a world that isn't one that you're already familiar with, which I suppose would be pretty much all movies. Because otherwise, what's the point? But the CIA seem to have latched onto this. They seem to have... I'm absolutely certain that Chase Brandon is a big Eyes Wide Shut fan. He seems to have cottoned on to the fact that movies are particularly good at creating a character, usually some sort of willing fool type character, who you identify with and who you want to... you actually want them to find out about this world. And in the olden days, in the days of classic conspiracy thrillers, 3 Days of the Condor, that sort of thing. Well, actually, that's a bad example because he is a CIA agent. What's a good one? The Parallax View, something like that. The character who is doing the investigating, who is being inducted into this world, and we are following their induction and thus being inducted ourselves, was usually a private investigator or a journalist or something like that. That's classic thriller territory. In modern thrillers, so often it's an FBI agent or a CIA agent. It's a Fox Mulder. It's a whatever the guy's called in The Recruit, James Clayton, of course. It's someone like that. So we're now not just identifying with a outsider who is somehow being inducted into the secret world. We're identifying with someone who is becoming an agent of that secret world, if they aren't already. So that's a dynamic that they very much the CIA have crowbarred into pretty much all of these films. You could actually argue there is an element of that in them. But particularly in Enemy of the State, you have Will Smith, you have... You could say Ben Stiller in the Meet the Parents, Meet the Fockers movies is a willing fool. He's a guy who is, you know, marrying into this family without a clue what he's getting into. And as he, you know, by the end of the second film, he's kind of figured it out a bit. He's kind of ascended into the circle of trust or whatever. So you have these kinds of ideas permeating all these films and these kinds of central characters, usually a young male who is... you know, identifiable for the sort of people that they are primarily aiming the movies at, which is people like me and Pierce, let's face it. And we are big film fans, so I don't really have too much of a problem with that. You know, if they want to make films that appeal to me, go right ahead. But in all seriousness, they're aiming at that kind of demographic, and so they're picking actors that would appeal to that demographic, shaping a character around them who is, like I say, being... shown behind the curtain themselves, whether they're entering into the agency or whether more like Will Smith, they are someone who just has all of this thrust upon them. And so we are being carried into these worlds and we are being shown things that we've never seen before, not just technological, but also, again, moral things, the sorts of moral dilemmas that spies actually have to go through. And invariably these films come out saying, oh, but isn't this a good thing? Isn't it good that they sort of won out over their humanity and made a really tough decision that, you know, drove this story forward and made them succeed in this world? But the fact that we're being asked to take on the mentality almost of secret agents firstly, that's a horrible mentality. It's a horrible job. It really is. It's a horrible thing for people to do for a living, for an occupation, with their lives, basically, is to deceive and manipulate continuously. But we are being invited to think that that's actually normal, or even a good thing. And that's how these films have very much worked, I feel. Would you agree, Pierce?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that that's, again, what's so creepy about them, is that this is, you know... doing horrible things, betraying your friends, hurting loved ones, killing, you know, colleagues at work. These are, you know, selling people out. These are all positive things because somebody's got to do it, you know? And aren't you glad that you don't have to, that we've got this wonderful organization that can do all of this and protect you at the same time from whatever, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Russia, whatever the hell the new boogeyman is. So, yeah, I think that's a really, it's really creepy. And it's really, it's once you understand it, it's pretty blatant. Because as you were saying, Tom, this is in like all of these films, even, in Charlie Wilson's War, the Charlie Wilson character, had no idea really what the CIA was up to, you know, or didn't really understand the type of operations that it was running, of course, because he was too busy doing coke with strippers in Las Vegas, but nonetheless, he's open, you know, he's entered into this world, and then suddenly he's meeting, you know, the president of Pakistan and doing all these crazy things. And again, in The Social Network, Jesse Eisenberg, the Mark Zuckerberg character, he is led into this world. You know, he starts as just some regular, you know, Joe Schmo at Harvard, and then suddenly he's meeting Peter Thiel, one of the richest people in the world, and getting a ton of money from him. He's meeting Sean Parker, another very mysterious character, who again was a hacker when he was 16 and was approached by the CIA very soon after he hacked a bunch of Fortune 500 companies to come and work for them. So, yeah, this is in all of these films. And again, I mean, this just goes to show that the CIA is very much in tune with the occult, very much in tune with the mystery schools, and understands the power that these institutions can have on people. Even if you're unaware that these things are in the films, even if this, you know, if you just go up to see your friend and you say, oh, don't you understand that you know this is the willing fool and he's the neophyte being taught by the, you know, secret mystery school teacher, they would sort of look at you like, what the fuck? But they're actually doing it quite a lot in these films, and I think they're doing it only because this is a meme that has, I mean, transcended time and culture and society. This is in, you know, all of the great sort of, you know, works of art deal with this many times, if not all the time. So they understand that implicitly, and they want to put that into these films, and they have done it over and over again. And again, the idea that we, the audience, we're obviously always the willing fool. In a movie, as Tom was saying, we are being led into a world we're not sure of. But when we're meant to identify with these people who many times are CIA agents, you know, like Charlie Wilson was an asset at the very least, that's a really powerful idea. That's a really powerful thing that they're using with us, that, you know, we average people, we are part of this. And I mean, on some level, I think that sort of is this sort of culture of fear that has been created after 9/11. You know, they would be completely content with everybody to sort of be mini CIA agents and sort of, you know, spying on one another and being very secretive. And, you know, they love that. They want to create that culture of fear. You know, I always talk about here in New York City. I mean, still to this day, you cannot get on a subway without hearing, you know, you're subject to random search. You know, they can go through your bag. If you see something, say something. Know that you know, black suitcase is really a bomb. And they constantly want you to be afraid. And again, they're doing that in so many of these CIA sponsored Hollywood films, because many times it is just the willing fool is completely unaware, and then suddenly he tumbles down this rabbit hole and he sees the truth, you know, or at least the glimpse of the truth that they want to allow us to see. And I think that was something we mentioned, like in The Good Shepherd, the portrayal of the CIA in that, aside from the fact that, you know, everybody in the movie is a member of Skull and Bones, and apparently all of the major decisions by the CIA were not made in Washington, but were actually made at the Skull and Bones retreat in Long Island. But in that, the portrayal is so negative and so harsh that I think it also, again, with that culture of fear, you don't even want to know about it. You know, you sort of want to turn off from that. And, well, just let those guys do it. Let those bonesmen and their weird rituals, they can handle what's going on in Guatemala, because I don't want to even know about it. You know, just give me some more DOD action movies and a couple more breaths, and I'll be content.
Well, and yeah, that speaks to the whole the dynamic that the intelligence services and other secret organizations derive their power from. It comes from the secrecy itself, but not just the secrecy, but the control over the small amount of information that you allow out there. Because like you're saying, the notion of completely secret power it's kind of a myth. I mean, if you're completely secret, then you don't really have any power. In order to have power, you have to expose yourself a little bit, while obviously trying not to let people know what you're really up to. And then the CIA, just like any secret society or any other intelligence or secret organization, absolutely knows this. And their power comes from that mystery. It comes from our uncertainty about what it is that they're doing and what it is that the world's really like. And so by, you know, providing us with these little glimpses behind the curtain, and I mean, just going back to, like, with Zero Dark Thirty and with the whole Bin Laden or so-called Bin Laden Abbottabad operation, that was amazing because in the 6 months or a year before that, nothing leaked. No one knew this operation was coming. It was never even hinted at in the press. It was hinted at in a Tom Clancy novel, but, you know, that's a different story. but you know what I mean? They kept total secrecy over that operation. And then as soon as it happened, Obama goes on TV and tells everyone. The Rent-A-Mob turns up and, you know, waving placards and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then you get all of these, you know, Navy SEALs and everything instantly start leaking, instantly start saying, oh, yeah, yeah, I knew about this. I knew this, yep. You know, I knew this was coming. Oh, the I Rock. Knew the guy who actually shot. Yeah, yeah, The Rock is there tweeting about this, saying, oh, my Navy cousin, my, you know, Navy SEAL cousin told me about this. And, you know, and it just, this tremendous outpouring of information, even to the extent that we then got this rather open admission of the CIA's involvement in the film Zero Dark Thirty, which, you know, mythologized this whole operation. And you've got to wonder, was that deliberate? Did they actually want us to know that they were behind Zero Dark Thirty, having, you know, saved this up and saved this up and saved up Bin Laden and the point at which we're actually going to rub out Bin Laden? They'd sort of had to hang on to that and be patient with it for a few years. And then, you know, they've got to keep it secret. Then they've got to do it, supposedly. Then they tell absolutely everyone. And they were almost like showing off that, you know, we told everyone that we killed Bin Laden. And everyone, for some stupid reason, believed us. For some inexplicable reason that I've never been able to put my finger on why so many people believed that. Because I know there's enough people out there, there's tons of people out there who are intelligent enough to not just buy that utterly implausible, ridiculous story about burying him at sea and all of that. So you know, why would anyone believe that story? Well, the reason is because we don't know otherwise. We're not certain enough because of this culture of secrecy and uncertainty and mystery that the CIA creates around themselves. And because we're so dependent on them to tell us, it's like, what other choice do we have? It's either uncertainty or believe the bullshit. And that's the whole power dynamic around the CIA. And, I mean, Kira, you were asking, why is it that we did this series? And it's like, why do we do all of this work? Why do we do this kind of work at all? And it's to try and take that power away from them, to try and take that mystery away from them, in as much as that's possible, in as much as we can do that. It's to try and demystify the CIA. Because if they're not mysterious, if they're just known as a criminal organization, which is what they are, then a lot of their power is gone. They just get revealed to be the mafia that they really are. No?
Right, right. And, you know, it occurred to me while you were talking about the demographics, how obviously these films are meant to appeal to guys like us, you know. I have noticed that, but it's particularly through TV that, you know, since Alias, there is actually this subculture genre of TV about the CIA that's really aimed at recruiting women.
And, oh, hell
yeah. And that's, you know, that's new. That is a new thing, and that's something I think we would benefit from exploring. And I thought about it also that I think a female director was picked for Zero Dark Thirty on purpose because of this, because I think that they've been perfecting this appeal to women genre in TV, and they're going to take it to film. Like, that's going to be the next step. But the first step was having a female director of Zero Dark Thirty. And then, you know, I think the next step will be to take what they've been doing with TV and really put it into movies.
Oh, and who's the hero of Zero Dark Thirty is the female analyst.
Exactly.
Who kind of, you know, sells her morality away and allows torture to go on. Oh, it's okay, because we got Bin Laden. who, of course, was being held in a military town, and, right next to the Pakistani military. But don't worry. I think this especially in TV, as you were saying, Kira, we had Alias. We have a show, State of Affairs, with Katherine Heigl, where she runs some CIA counterterrorism. Of course, me and Tom's favorite CIA TV show, Homeland, features Claire Danes as Carrie Matheson. I mean, part of me just thinks that they've kind of flooded the market with men, and they're realizing that they need women in the clandestine services, maybe even more now. Maybe as a cultural norm sort of shift and whatnot, they need more women. You can't just have men running around. There's only so much that men are going to be able to do. This is sexist sort of thing, but, I mean, you need women to seduce men many times, and that is indeed what a lot of CIA operatives and our women are doing overseas. And again, absolutely, that comes up in the latest season of Homeland. Again, Carrie uses her sexuality in order to get information about a high level terrorist. So, yeah, I mean, I think they now it's all about women. And again, to sort of As cultural norms shift, so does the CIA. So now the CIA doesn't want to just seem like a bunch of sort of East Coast elites that are mostly men in these very macho, vaguely homoerotic secret societies, like Skull and Bones and things like that. Now that, no, we're not like that. We're super open. We love everybody. We love minorities. We love women. I'm just waiting for, multiracial, transgendered CIA agent. That's going to be the new sort of thing that they're going to start pushing, because, again, they need to shift. They need to reinvent themselves. Whereas a lot of other agencies don't really do that. There's not as many agencies that are willing to sort of approach that head on, only when they need to, like we're seeing with the military pretending to care about rape and violence towards women within the military. They have to now. They have to address it. Whereas the CIA is very much about being upfront about that. So, like you said, I mean, now it's a lot of TV shows dealing with these powerful women within the CIA.
Yeah, and another show is Covert Affairs. I think it's on cable on USA. And that one, the whole series is very open about her role of seducing people to try to turn them. That's like just one of the tools in the toolbox to turn people to get them on the CIA side. So it's becoming a part of the narrative, I guess you should. You would say it's not just foreign agents that are turned and then, asked to use their bodies for the CIA, but it's part of your role as a female CIA agent, openly.
Oh, and well, you should be proud of that too.
Right.
Yeah, sure. That's very much, I mean, that's the cultural and moral norm that they seem to be shifting towards. But it's the same thing over here. If you look at the show Spooks, which is like the equivalent of that trio of CIA-sponsored shows, 24, Alias, and The Agency, that all came out immediately after 9/11, in this country you have the equivalent show, which was Spooks, which was assisted by the British security services. And there isn't a central female character, because it is kind of a broadcast, but certainly there are very prominent female characters in that. And there are some episodes where they're quite explicitly using their sexuality to not necessarily sleeping with people, but certainly going down that road of seduction and sexual manipulation in order to gain information or to engineer someone into a position of blackmail or whatever it is. And so there again, I think you have some kind of mission statement in these PR offices for these intelligence agencies of, we've got to attract more women. We've got it's not just as a, you know, political correctness quota thing. It's actually that we need women to do certain things for us. Like you say, Pierce, you just, you know, there's some things that you just men can't do. So, and they've actually had quite a number of like mainstream newspaper articles quite explicitly admitting this in the British press in recent years, last 2-3 years, I'm thinking, where they're saying we need more young, well, certainly we need more women, but also we need more teenagers. They're talking about, you know, recruiting people straight out of school or even while they're still at school and things like this. And you think they're quite explicitly admitting this in newspapers and they're putting this into popular culture. This clearly is an agenda. This is clearly something, a decision has been made that this is something that they are wanting to do. This isn't just some confluence or coincidence of events. This is the modern intelligence service. This is how they now conceive of themselves, quite necessarily, because this is, you know, the world we have. So,
yeah, yeah. And even I was thinking that the name of that show, Covert Affairs, I mean, the series is about her series of secret affairs that she engages in for the CIA.
You know? She is an undercover agent.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All those metaphors are there.
Right, right.
Spylingo, they really are. They have been for a long time.
Right, yeah. Because it's sexy being a spy, you know. It's hot, you know. It's awesome.
Who wouldn't want to fall in love with a Russian spy?
Yeah.
And then kill her, you know?
Yeah. When you get bored with her, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, move on to the, you know, whatever, the next one.
Oh goodness. So, where do you want to take this now? Into your second season. You're introducing have you gone into your second season yet, or are you just putting it together now?
We're sort of taking a little bit of a break, because it was an intense like recording schedule and I think it'll come across, but I mean, we put a lot of work and research into all of this, and there's a ton of stuff we didn't even, you know, get to cover. There's lots of interesting connections, like particularly on the production side, you know, all the same producers, the same actors, directors keep popping up. So I think we're gonna handle all that in the second season, but we haven't even released all the first season, so
we have a vague sketch for where we're going in the second season. We're going to do a similar sort of thing. It's going to be quite a broad show, but I don't know, the vague idea at least for the second season is to do a series of quite different episodes trying to show how this technically works as a mechanism, in as much as we can figure that out, in as much as we have decent evidence on that, but to look at how this plays out differently in a number of different productions, because the CIA's relationship to Hollywood isn't just a straightforward one where they just say you have to do this and they go, oh, well, sometimes it is like that, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it is more subtle or more careful or more momentary, if you like, in the production process, and sometimes, you know, these agencies just go out and hire some production company to make some film for them. Sometimes it is just that obvious and that straightforward. And so we were going to try and look at how this, just how this plays out in different kinds of ways across different sorts of films. We're certainly going to be getting into George Clooney and CBS and that whole mess, because the more we've looked at that, the more we keep coming up with stunning connections and evidence that not only that CBS has for a long time been a deeply CIA-involved organization, but that George Clooney now seems to be involved in mythologizing that history of the CIA and CBS, if that makes sense. Or at least he made a couple of movies that very, very much did this. And so he's going to be something that we're going to focus on quite specifically, I think, in one episode. We're certainly going to take on some of the Bond movies. We're certainly going to do The Quiet American, which is an adaptation of Graham Greene's book. We're probably going to get into The Interview and this whole CIA clique at Sony that we've been exploring through the Sony hack emails and so on. These are just our plans, our kind of sketched out plans at the moment. But that's where we're going with this, because there is a whole lot more to come, and we are going to try and, just as we did in the first season, or as you will realize when you listen to the whole thing, we do build. There are certain things. It is probably best to listen to these episodes in order, because there are certain ideas that we pick up early on and then elaborate on and then build on as the show goes on. And so that's also what we want to do in season two, is to see where else can we push this to? How can we make this as broad an analysis of the CIA's involvement in Hollywood as possible? Because there's no point, if all we wanted to do was establish that this was a phenomenon and show off some of the information that we'd found out, we'd just make a 40-minute documentary doing that. We wouldn't make an eight-hour podcast discussion series. We've done that because we want it to be a fleshed-out, rounded look at these things. And this is why we get guests on as well, is to offer other perspectives that we wouldn't think of, so that the people going away from this can look back at these films and think, there's a lot more to them. There's a lot more going on in these films than they probably would have considered, and probably even would normally consider possible, maybe. But I mean, that's the other kind of objective for me, is just to get people to take these things a bit more seriously. Because this is a serious business. This really is. Propaganda is not some, you know, the best propaganda is very subtle. It's the best propaganda is something you don't even recognize that it is propaganda. And that's what they've done with Hollywood. Most people don't seem to realize that actually Hollywood's possibly a more effective propaganda tool than the news networks are. People get that the news networks lie to them. The notion of Hollywood politically lying to them, it's not on most people's radar, I wouldn't even think. So if we can provide people with some of the ideas and a few of the tools and some of the information to take these things more seriously, then we've largely accomplished what it is we're trying to do. And so, yeah, in season two, we're just going to try and push for more of that and better of that.
And again, Kira, you were sort of asking us before, you know, why we're doing this, why we're, you know, so deeply involved in the research in this. And I think, again, as Tom was saying, this is a serious thing that's going on. And particularly this relationship between Hollywood and the CIA and to the U.S. government in general is very deep. You know, just the other day, Angelina Jolie was at the U.N., complaining about how horrible the Syrian government is and all of these refugees and things like that. And you're sort of, you know, watching this thinking, why the hell is she at the UN? Why is she a member of the Council on Foreign Relations? What, you know, in what sense does this, you know, what other, you know, in many other countries, I mean, you would sort of laugh them off if there was some, you know, I don't know, Bollywood star, you know, going to the UN. I mean, you wouldn't think that that's possible. But here in America, you've got so many actors in groups like the CFR, you know, working with, you know, Ben Affleck, for instance, runs a, George Clooney, I believe, excuse me. George Clooney runs a NGO, deals mostly with South Sudan and Sudan and Darfur as well. I mean, he runs this with John Prendergast, who is a notorious deep state agent and was very involved in the genocide in Rwanda. Why are these actors so deeply involved in not just the sort of propaganda, but I mean involved in on-the-ground sort of things? You know, Clooney has set up this satellite to track alleged violence going on in Darfur. And obviously, there is a ton of violence going on, but this is just an actor. I mean, why are we allowing celebrities this sort of access? Why are they allowed to have this sort of influence going on? And you really have to understand that, I mean, this goes beyond actors supporting a particular politician. I mean, they are supporting a very specific agenda. And they seem to have no qualms with getting in bed with psychopaths and mass murderers and drug traffickers. So this is like a broad sort of a thing. And unfortunately, it seems as if there are fewer and fewer actors and actresses in Hollywood that are willing to sort of speak out about this. I mean, I don't really know if there's very many at all. You know, people that come to my head, like Ed Asner, is very much, I would assume, dislikes the CIA as he understands, you know, what more or less what happened on 9/11. But aside from a handful of people, who of course get obscured. You know, God forbid you ever say something negative about either Hollywood or the government, they're going to, you know, shun you forever. But they are creating a very bizarre sort of grouping of people that, with actors, with directors. I mean, you know, you look at the Sony hack, the CEO of Sony, Michael Linton, in some of these emails, it's extraordinary the level of access that this guy has to the White House, to other CIA agents. I mean, he just sort of casually talks about, you know, convincing Valerie Jarrett, Obama's sort of main advisor, to fast-track the appointment of a Sony music executive to the head of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia. So the CIA's propaganda arm, you know, is being headed by a Sony executive. I mean, the amount of influence that these people have, I mean, this is almost going beyond propaganda. So this is really, you know, again, and that's something we're going to be exploring again in the second season, and of course, sort of broadening it out, because it's, you know, and I mean, maybe even eventually we'll get into other aspects of the entertainment industry, because you know, I mean, I can only assume it's not just in Hollywood. Obviously, that's a big one right now, but it's everywhere. So again, this is really an all-encompassing sort of operation that's going on.
Yeah, and it's not just the mainstream either. The alternatives are chosen for us as well. You know, you look at, gosh,
Charlie Sheen. Why the fuck does anyone buy anything he says? Because he's a Hollywood actor. You know, why would a Hollywood actor lie about 9/11 truth? Because he's a cokehead, you know. Because you know, I have no idea. But again, you're right, and you know, you're right to say that, Kira. It's not just Charlie Sheen, Roseanne Barr. You know, she says one thing about MK Ultra. Suddenly, oh yeah, Roseanne knows about this. And again, the sorts of actors that really expose things, like Corey Feldman or Corey Haim, either wind up dead or laughed off. They're silly. They don't know what they're talking about. There's no pedophilia in Hollywood. You know, forget that. Let's all go back to Charlie Sheen on Alex Jones screaming about something.
Right. Or, you know, let's all vote for Jesse Ventura when he runs for president.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of pointed that I saw something about that today in social media about him considering a run for president. And I'm like, the guy's an actor, you know, like Reagan. Oh, well, he's much better than Reagan. He's playing a role. He's just playing the alternative role. I mean, you know, he's an X-Files. I mean, an old X-Files actor where he played like the, you know, the Black Ops weirdo, you know, that shows up and...
Sure.
Yeah. I guess maybe it has something to do also with age. You know, if these people, you know, who are thinking in these ways that, yeah, the alternative is really an alternative, that they're just not old enough to see how it's all scripted for us. All of it.
Or at least that when something like a Jesse Ventura emerges, they will promote the hell out of it. I mean, you've got to wonder, why is it that that guy got given the money and the time and the resources and everything to make this really, you know, shoddy tabloid conspiracy theory show? Why him? He's not exactly got a long track record of, you know, investigating government conspiracy or anything. In fact, his lead researcher on that show was a woman called June Sarpong, who used to present this, like, crappy Sunday morning kids TV show in this country. She's, I mean, not to slag the woman off, but you know what I mean. It's not like any of these people were sincere investigators or came from a investigative documentary background or something like that. The whole thing was just this, you know, flashy, noisy nonsense. And so why does that door get opened for him to make that sort of a show? And of course, it was a show that just touched on all of the big conspiracies. It was just, let's do one show on 9/11, let's do one show on JFK, let's do one show on chemtrails. All right, okay. So you basically just covered everything that we've already heard. But for some reason, people bought into this and watched it and thought that this was somehow a breakthrough in television or something. And I'm like, this is the stuff that's been around for ever. It's just, it's always, you know, there's always been this kind of stuff there. And they just, I think they pick and choose the bits of it that they like and feed that into these sorts of shows. Because they, like, again, they know that conspiracy is out there. They know that people are aware that governments get involved in conspiratorial criminal behavior. So how do you deal with that? Well, you mix a few of the real ones in with a few of the fake ones. You mush it all over with UFOs, obviously. And you hope that everyone just either gives up and goes to bed or just goes crazy and goes out hunting little green men. Because if they're doing either one of those, they're in no way a threat to you. So jobs are gooden, if you like.
Right, right. And, you know, not only why was he given this show and how on earth did he become a governor? And, you know, the show is easily, like, debunked. Like, there's not even factual stuff in there. I mean, there's actually outright, like, not factual stuff in there that's easily proven by, you know, a simple Google search or, you know, I mean, just easily proven as, like, complete and total bullshit. So why wasn't he taken to task for that? Because, well, that's the stuff they wanted to get out there for, to siphon off any sort of curiosity about, you know, what's really going on.
Well, I think they... Sorry, go on, Pierce.
No, no, go ahead, Tom. No, no.
Well, all I was going to say is they quite like that dialogue where... that's like Jesse Ventura or Alex Jones, where it's very didactic. It's very about saying, oh, well, this happened, and this is true. And so, therefore, everything I'm saying must be true, kind of thing. Rather than anyone who says, well, we actually have these 20 bits of evidence, and these are the three most likely ways of making sense of them. They hate people doing that. There's no way on earth you would see a mainstream TV series that did that with the topic of conspiracy. No, they want tabloid TV. Because if people are just shouting so-called facts at each other, 90% of which aren't even true, again, you're no threat to them. Because anyone who actually might take you seriously, like you say, Kira, will just go and do a Google search and find out, oh, three-quarters of this is bollocks. I mean, they just made this up or heard Jesse Ventura say it and therefore thought it was true. And, yeah, they love that sort of dialogue. And I don't know about Jesse Ventura himself, who or what the hell he is. Just like I say, I'm sure doors have been opened for him because it's useful to them to do that.
Mm. Yeah. A wrestler.
I think he gets a pass, too. He gets a pass because he's a celebrity. In the same way that a lot of these, you know, celebrities will run their mouth about something that they think they know. You know, point in case, Angelina Jolie, you know, as a UN ambassador. I mean, what the hell does she know? When she's not, you know, kidnapping children from all over the world, you know, to add to her menagerie with Brad Pitt. I mean, she's making these, like, god-awful movies. I mean, what, you know, she's so far removed from the reality of geopolitics, but... Because she's Angelina Jolie, we need to bow down at, you know, whatever the hell she says, you know, because why would an actor lie? You know, why would this lovable you know, person, why would they ever lie? So I think Jesse Ventura kind of gets a pass. And I just find it ridiculous that so much of the conversation about Hollywood and the CIA and the sort of government relationship always sort of reverts to the Illuminati. Or some sort of hidden gay agenda that's going on with the satanic cults. But yet when some celebrity pops up and sort of mouths something that you think it means that they're agreeing with you, they will believe this person like he's the second coming of Christ. I don't under, you know, and again, you know, why, to go back to why we do this, because the Illuminati shit is so stupid. And there is an actual... you know, cabal sort of going on, but it's not a satanic cult, not on, you know, any level like what people are talking about. I mean, this is deeper. This is the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, this is, again, why Michael Linton, the head of Sony, why is he on the board members of the RAND Corporation? You know, this is a much, much deeper sort of thing going on. And, but just to go back, I mean, yeah, I mean, these celebrities get a pass on everything. You know, the same way that they can do horrible things and then they can get, you know, You know, they can say something racist when they're drunk, you know, in front of a cop, and then they can get, you know, vindicated a week later. You know, right now we got this whole thing with Ben Affleck and his slave-owning great-great-great-grandfather, and that he was, you know, editing things, or was, you know, forcing PBS to edit out that and all this other stuff. And, you know, a week from now, everyone will have forgotten that, and, you know, Ben Affleck will travel back to the Congo, and everyone will just sort of, oh, yeah, right, he's great, don't worry about it.
Yeah, and the official story on that was, like, well, his occult great-grandfather was more interesting, so we focused on that.
Yeah, I know. Which is so bizarre. I was like, that's okay? Like, you know, he's into that, but not, you know, and then of course now it's come out that his mother was never a freedom rider. So, you know, I'm actually really, really happy about how that's turned out, because there's a special place in hell, I hope, for Ben Affleck. And, you know, any time that he has to squirm in front of a camera is just amazing for me. So thanks again, Ben, for all of that.
And just one other little side effect of all of this, of course, is that it means that we increasingly treat politicians in that same way, where we give them a pass, where it's like, he may have taken a load of money from this bunch of bastards, and he may have voted for this piece of legislation that completely screwed over this whistleblower, but you know, he said a few things about you know, freedom that I liked, so yeah. I guess all that other stuff's fine, because you know, he once said something I liked, so that must mean he's a good person, and therefore all of his other crimes are forgiven. And this whole mixture of, you know, celebrity politics, the intelligence services, that's one of the real outcomes of it, is that it's completely ruined political dialogue. It's turned it into a, oh well, but I like the way he looks, or I like that thing he said once, or you know, whatever. And people will just find any excuse, in just the same way as people will be excusing Ben Affleck for... I mean, not that Ben Affleck himself has necessarily done all that much.
No, not at all.
But, well, he did try and get them to edit out an embarrassing piece of family history. I'm sure he is not the first person to have done that, let's put it that way. But you know what I'm saying here, that it really does... It just leads us down this path of where we're, because we're identifying, it's the same as with the dynamic of the CIA and secrecy. It's that, oh, because they've given us this little tidbit of what we wanted, we feel that we kind of owe them something, if you like, for making us feel slightly good about ourselves once in a movie or something. I mean, whatever it is that we're praising them for. And so you just end up with this, again, it's a sort of abusive Stockholm syndrome relationship, where, you know, because we're so starved of anyone talking about anything that actually matters in a meaningful way, if someone does it, suddenly, oh God, they're, you know, this is everything we always wanted. We've got a mainstream television show talking about chemtrails. I mean, this is amazing. And you just think, I mean, honestly, it's not going to make a damn bit of difference to anything. And it just keeps you addicted to this, you know, drip, drip, tiny little, you know, like a drug addiction. Okay, we'll just give you a little bit here, just at the point at which you were starting to get really pissed off and might have stopped watching TV altogether, we'll give you a conspiracy show with Jesse Ventura, just to make sure that you stay addicted. Things like that. And I just think, you know, break with that dynamic completely. Just stop watching it. Or if you do watch it purely out of choice, and know that you're making a choice to watch it, and then turn it off when it finishes and walk away. Don't watch whatever's on after it. That's how people should approach culture, or at least mass culture, popular culture. That's really, I mean, that's how I approach it. I know what it is that I'm doing. I have a good relationship with the things that I am watching. I do not allow myself to be poisoned by this crap. And I just really, really hope that there's got to be some power in helping other people realize that that's actually really quite a simple thing to do, and a much healthier way to be towards popular culture. And if we can, again, if we can accomplish some of that and help provide people with some of the tools to do that, I'm really happy with that as an accomplishment, with that as an outcome. So, yeah, I hope that's what we've done in this series. I really do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you've definitely gone into some of the deeper questions that I haven't really heard out there about these particular issues. One of the things that that I was thinking about when you were talking about this mix of, you know, politics and actors and politicians. And Obama really upped that whole mix of Washington with Hollywood and with the music industry in, you know, in his whole image. And I think that was extremely well crafted on his part and continues to be.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I was just reading an article today on the Hill website, and, you know, it was just a who's who of actors lending their support to Hillary Clinton. Again, as if why should that even matter? But yeah, no, Obama really, I mean, just sort of took it. I think that's why, though. Now, again, each politician sort of raises the bar a little bit. And Obama was, I mean, is so much involved in Hollywood. I mean, he gets such a ton of money from Hollywood, you know, producers and things of that nature. And his whole entire campaign was so, you know, scripted and very flashy, much like a Hollywood film, that now, of course, you know, everyone has got to sort of go even, you know, raise the bar even more. And it's, you know, it's not to the point where you can't run for public office, you know, especially the president, without having at least one or two celebrities in your back pocket endorsing you. You know, everybody from the, you know, Chuck Norris and his whole thing, and the fucking idiots at that Duck Commander, the Duck Whistle Company, to, again, you know, the sort of classic, you know, Ben Affleck and Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt and Lena Dunham, you know, is pimping herself out to, you know, all the Democrats right now. So, yeah, as Tom was saying, it blurs the line where, I mean, what are you even voting for anymore? And you can look no further than Obama. I mean, this guy who had nothing going on. I mean, he was barely a state senator. You know, there's next to nothing else that would really qualify him to be the president. But yet, I mean, people vote for him. People still defend him when there's really nothing to defend him on. I mean, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to point to a single piece of legislation or a single action that he's done that's positive. I mean, I can't think of anything, really. So, again, and this is this, like, Hollywoodization of politics. You know, and of course, there's Paul Begala, who is just a real nasty little turd, who helped run Bill Clinton's campaign. Of course, said Washington is Hollywood with for ugly people. So, you know, that's
him included.
Great. Yeah, I mean, that's a great, you know, metaphor for what all this is. And along the same lines, this is sort of a bit of a tangent, but there's a really interesting show that was on HBO a while back called K Street, which was directed by Steven Soderbergh and produced by George Clooney, and it was filmed in Washington, D.C., and it revolves around a fictional lobbyist organization run by Mary Matlin and James Carville, who are, of course, husband and wife, and you know, worked against each other when Bill Clinton was first running for president. And it is this bizarre melding of Hollywood and Washington, and the episodes are so bizarre. And they have a lot of real politicians who weren't even aware that they were in a TV show. And then sometimes they were very aware that they were, you know, part of this TV show, and they get them to say the most bizarre things, and you sort of end the show and you're not really sure. I mean, what are these? Are these actors? Was that guy really a lobbyist for such and such an organization? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really it's a bizarre level, and you can't tell anymore.
Well, and just to add a little something to that, let's not forget it was Obama's wife who presented the Oscar for Argo.
Yes.
In right. The world's strangest Oscar ceremony ever, perhaps, or at least so far, let's say.
Yeah.
they could up it. And also just people like a guy who no one, it seems, knows about this guy, a guy called Rich Klein, who worked in the State Department under the original Clinton presidency, not the forthcoming Clinton presidency. And he is now he now works for McClarty Associates, this DC law firm, who are very, very deep state and very, very connected to everything. And again, their CEO is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, like everyone else. and he's now working, he runs their media arm. He does consultancy to films, among them The Interview, this, you know, the film that was at the center of the Sony Pictures hack. And so you've got people like him as well, who, just as we've identified, you know, there is some this sort of revolving door around, like, the Pentagon and military contract firms. There is something of a revolving door around media and mainstream politics. That, you know, you can be an official for the State Department, and, you know, now you can, when you leave doing that, you end up in some very, very well-connected law firm helping films to, you know, gain access to ambassadors and whatever else it is that this guy does. And I'm sure, give it a few more years, that guy might well end up back in a government agency somewhere. Or if he doesn't, then his equivalent at another firm will. And so you've got to understand, there's that. I think there's that same dynamic and that same process going on there as well. That, you know, those as those two worlds become ever more intertwined and ever more overlapping, that the people in them are just going to, you know, keep wandering around on the same little sort of patch of earth, you know. One year they're in this office in DC, and the next year they're in another office in DC. But, you know, it's all the same job as far as they're concerned, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you have that revolving door with the news people and politics as well. People going back and forth between news organizations and politics, and, you know, that whole relationship there that... you know, we're taught that we have this independent, you know, media, that the news is, you know, they've really uncovered it themselves, and, you know, we can trust it because it's, you know, it's all independent.
It's NBC. Why would they lie, you know?
Right. So we have a few more minutes left. Is there anything else about the series that you wanted to get across? I know that you have done a little sort of connections key there that you might want to tell them about, because I found that extraordinarily interesting myself.
Yeah, sure. If people want to get a kind of overview of this series, or at least the kind of connections and some of the information and stuff that we put together... we did make it's called a link chart. It's like an intelligence-style link chart, where we've included the CIA agents and the major kind of production creative personnel that were involved in these films, and a whole bunch of links to their personal websites and their IMDb profiles, interviews with them, making-of documentaries, all kinds of stuff that just to try and open this door for people even more, so that there's another way for them to kind of... another access point, if you like, another way in to understanding this a bit better. If you just search either on my site, or I think if you just search on a search engine for the CIA and Hollywood link chart, you'll probably find it. You'll certainly find it if you go on my site, spyculture.com. And yeah, you can either download it as a PDF or you can use the HTML version. I prefer the PDF version, but it's up to you, really. And yeah, that's just a kind of guide to, not just to this series, but to how this whole clique in Hollywood works. Because this is something that, it is quite a large network in a way. That link chart only shows what we looked at in this first season, which is by no means all of the information that we have. No. It really isn't. So... it is a relatively large network in terms of the number of people involved, you might say, but it's a very, very interconnected network. A lot of these people work with a lot of others of these people, and a lot of these people work on multiple films time and time again with the same crew. So it's a clique, yeah. I mean, this is what we keep calling it, and I think that's the most accurate description for it. It is the CIA's clique in Hollywood. So that's what that link chart shows you and represents.
And it is a powerful visual. The first time I saw it, it captivated me and really brought me into all of what you're trying to convey, that It is all connected, and just look at it right here. And it's sometimes hard to conceptualize of all those connections without that kind of a visual. So it is a great tool, and I hope that people check it out.
Well, and of course we will do one for the second season as well. And maybe over time we will try and integrate all of this information together into a larger one that tries to encompass at least most of this clique and most of the stuff that we have. But that's... Yeah. we've already put so much work into this series that adding more tasks is not necessarily something we're that keen on doing right now. But rest assured, there will be a second season of the CIA in Hollywood, and almost certainly a third season as well, assuming we live that long. So, this isn't something that's going away. It's just something where, you know, we only have so many hours. We wish we could do more with this, but we just do the best we can with what we've got. So hopefully that gets through to people.
And on that note, I mean, I really encourage all the people listening to the show to do their own research and let us know if they find anything interesting. Because, you know, as Tom was saying, there's only so much time that we have to do this. And there's going to be stuff that we inevitably miss. So, you know, anyone listening to the series, you know, let us know if you find something interesting, if you come across a document, if you come across a, I mean, I definitely get quite a few recommendations from people on Twitter for different movies, including a couple that I are connected to some of the films that me and Tom did in the first season, a couple directors who made some interesting movies recently. Let us know if you find anything interesting. You know, we'd be very happy to talk about it.
Great. Well, thank you both for joining me tonight. And thanks for all the work that you've done in this series. And I'm really enjoying it myself, so I highly recommend that the listeners check it out.
Well, thank you, Kira, for having us on again. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate everything you do, and your listeners are fantastic. So thank you again.
All right.
Yeah, well, thanks, Kira. It's it's been another good conversation. And just quickly before we sign off, if people haven't already gone and checked out this series, which some of you I'm sure won't have, you can get it either at Pierce's website, which is PorkinsPolicyReview.com, or at my website, which is spyculture.com. You can download it or watch it via video or whatever from either of those sites.
Great. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pahacha, eyuha na.